The election is over, and Hoosier voters have retained Chief Justice Loretta Rush on the state Supreme Court. After 10 years on the bench, what has she accomplished, and what's next for Loretta Rush? I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my interview with the Chief Justice weeks before Election Day. We talked about her goals and concerns for the legal system, including the safety of court officials. The Chief Justice now travels with security after a growing number of threats and after someone broke into her home, assaulting her and her husband. Loretta Rush says there's nothing more important right now than maintaining the public's trust and confidence in our legal system. 2 Main Street with Indiana Chief Justice Loretta Rush is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger, Kim Wren, and the Berger Wealth Services team at Bayard Private Wealth Management. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, the election is over, and voters have delivered their verdict on whether to retain 3 Indiana Supreme Court justices. And the results show all 3 easily won the retention vote. No Indiana Supreme Court justice has lost a retention vote since being on the ballot in 1970. There was a social media campaign to oust the justices after they upheld the near-total abortion ban the Republican legislature voted into law in 2023. Now, Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Justices Mark Massa and Derek Moulter have another 10 years on the bench. Weeks before the election, I sat down with Chief Justice Loretta Rush, and we talked about her tenure on the High Court and the goals, challenges, and accomplishments of the Hoosier legal system. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. And yes, court is in session with Indiana Chief Justice Loretta Rush. Justice Rush is the 2024 Speaker of the Evansville Bar Association Shepherd Lecker Series. She's Indiana's first female Chief Justice, a position she's held for 10 years. And before joining the state's highest court, Justice Rush was an attorney for a Lafayette, Indiana law firm and a juvenile court judge for 13 years. Loretta Hogan Rush was appointed to the Indiana Supreme Court by Governor Mitch Daniels and took the oath of office as the state's 108th Supreme Court Justice in November of 2012. She's a Pennsylvania native and a graduate of Purdue and the Indiana University School of Law. So, Chief Justice Loretta Rush, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here.
Thank you, David.
How was your session at the Law Academy?
It was wonderful. It's my second time to go there. We brought the whole court down and had an oral argument at University of Southern Indiana, and I went over there. I try to stop by schools when I travel to a city, so students were great. I was really pleased with how many of them wanted to be lawyers or judges.
Well, that's one of your pushes, isn't it, to get more attorneys in Indiana?
Yes, it is.
So what's your pitch?
It's a great job. It is. I've been a judge and a lawyer for 42 years, and it's a profession where you can really make a difference in people's lives. You can help people, and it's so important to kind of living in a free society that we have a strong rule of law, strong judiciary, and that we resolve disputes mm-hmm. in lieu of chaos.
Well, and argumentative? Were you an argumentative person when you'd like to?
No, not particularly. I was always, I was a big reader. Mm-hmm. But I liked advocating for my clients.
Okay, there you go.
And I enjoy advocating for the judiciary now as Chief Justice.
What's a better way of putting it than argumentative?
Yes.
Okay, very well. Very well done. A lot of important topics to talk about, and probably none more important right now than the public's trust and confidence in our legal system. Would you agree?
Yes. Let me explain.
Yes,
I agree.
Please.
I mean, it's something I think about and I work on daily. You know, I just went to Arsenal High School last week for Constitution Day, and I met with the students. How many of you trust the judiciary? Mm-hmm. Didn't see a lot of hands go up.
Yeah.
And that's problematic when we live in a society that is based on the rule of law. I've had the opportunity. I was a president of the Conference of Chief Justices to travel the world, and I've seen judicial systems that they didn't have trust, where they have to set up anti-corruption courts, where it takes 10 years to get a case resolved. And it's problematic for their government. It's problematic for living in a free democracy. So the trust in the courts, you have in Indiana, you have over 1 million cases filed a year. There's 2 parties to every case. So you look at public institutions, no institutions used more than the courts, maybe the BNV. I don't know. So people need to think that they're going to get fair, impartial judges that are quickly and efficiently decide their cases so they can move on. I mean, when people come to court, often it could be the worst day of their lives. And to have a strong judiciary is key. And to have people trust when they stand in that courtroom, as so many Hoosiers have to, that they're going to get a good, fair decision and be able to move on with their lives is key.
So what's the problem right now?
I think it's not just judiciary. I think it's in public institutions. I think the lack of civil discourse has been problematic. In applying the rule of law, you may not like the decision, but the judge has a rule. Under separation of powers, the judges have to apply the law as written, and then there's some gray areas that we have to develop the law and make that. So I think that the sort of shouting and anger and name-calling is problematic. I have judges are telling me now that they're being disrespected tremendously in court. You would never want to flip off a judge, really. Mm-hmm. But they're seeing that because they're not respecting the authority that comes behind it. But I also think that authority has to be earned. You have to have a system where you efficiently, fairly, and inexpensively get cases decided so people can get back on their lives. So it's a two-edge. We have to work hard to get that trust. And then we have to do things like me talking with you today. I do a lot of interviews, a lot of our judges. We have cameras in the courtroom now.
Right.
We've got a court system that you can, my case, Indiana, you can get online now and see almost every case in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I think the transparency is key so people can see how hardworking our judiciary is.
I know you also encourage judges to get out in the community.
Very much so. I think that where are the courthouses? They're in the center of every community. And I call us sort of the government emergency rooms for some of society's biggest issues. I mean, substance abuse, mental health, violence, and the cases that we see. So it's important that you work within your larger community. The primary referral source for people to get treatment is the criminal justice system. I mean, you don't think about that.
No, you don't.
Judiciary. So you think about 70% of people in jails have a substance abuse, mental health, or co-occurring. How do we train our judges? What are the services at work so we don't have this revolving door of people in and out of the criminal justice system? And it's an issue with public safety. So you've got to balance that out. But our judges have been wonderful. Your judges, you have fantastic judges in Evansville. You've got some of the state's best judicial leaders down here. Look at what they're doing. I was just Veterans Court. There's a Veterans Court today. I was just talking to Judge Sively about his problem-solving courts. They're passionate about doing better. We also have family recovery courts. When can a family, when they get together, get the children back with the family safely as a parent's going through recovery and substance abuse? And if they can't, you know, make sure that you make timely plans for that child so that child doesn't languish in foster care.
Now, you've been very outspoken about Indiana's attorney shortage. There's an Indiana Supreme Court commission to encourage lawmakers to help fund legal startups and scholarship programs for attorneys in underserved areas. How's that going?
Well, it's just started. We've got our first group of recommendations. And think about it. A lot of people say, do we really need – think about the lawyer jokes, right? Do we really need more lawyers? But think about you're in a rural community and you cannot afford an attorney and you're charged with a crime. And the Constitution says you have a right to representation. That's a problem. So when we don't have prosecutors in counties, when we don't have public defenders, when we don't have even judges with regard to areas of the state that the attorney has sort of aged, you know, we've lost our attorneys. And what is going to happen? So we're really looking at lots of different options for that. But it really is, when you look at what your constitutional rights are, you have a constitutional right to be represented in these situations. And who wants to stand looking at, be charged with something and not be able to have somebody represent them in court? It is not what sort of the foundational underpinnings of our Constitution says with regard to that. So,
you kind of issued a challenge to lawmakers, didn't you?
Yes.
To come up with some funding for these programs.
And we'll work on funding too. So what do you do? Let's say you want to go through law school and you want to become a public defender, but you've got $130,000 worth of debt and that job pays $50,000 a year. We're losing that. We lost Valparaiso Law School, which was a wonderful.
Yes.
I'd love to have a law school down here in Evansville. Anyone else there's listening? I mean, you've got USI, University of Evansville. You've just got a great center. I love your med school down here.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to have affordable legal education where we can have people go into these public servant sort of roles. The attorney general's office, I mean, public defenders, they have openings, just dozens of openings, which really tax the system that we have with regard to representation. And that's on top of civil legal aid. You think about a grandmother, you think about the drug crisis we have, and if grandparents want to get legal custody of their grandkids, they can get them registered in school because parents are suffering from any of a number of substance abuse, mental health, or both, and they can't afford an attorney. And mm-hmm. how do they get the paperwork to go? So right. it's necessary.
You mentioned drug abuse. I know you're on this opioid task force, and we do have some good news, though, about just recently came out that between April of 2023 and April of 2024, overdose deaths declined 10% nationwide. That's the largest decrease on record.
Yes, that was big news.
That was big news.
We have lost so many to overdose. I used to carry Narcan in my car because I would see somebody overdosing on the street.
Really?
Yes, I did. I mean, it's just we had people overdose in courtrooms, particularly with the fentanyl. Fentanyl right now is just a killer. So, yes, the overdose deaths are really, when I was chairing the National Opioid Task Force, at that point in the country, there had been about 550,000 overdose wow. to deaths. And it's not just the person that overdoses, it's the kids, it's the families, it's the overdose.
Effect, that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then it's the generational issue where you see, you want to break that generational cycle of substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about the shortage of attorneys. Indiana's 92 counties have fewer lawyers per capita than the national average, and especially in these rural areas. Any counties that are really hurting right now?
We actually have I think it's up on our website too. I think we've got some counties that they're really hurting. We're, as a state, I think we're in the bottom 10% of the country for attorneys per capita. And there's some that are like, you know, have one-tenth of that, of wow. what's required. So we can follow that, and we sort of have a heat map and show. And I always encourage people going from law school, do you want to be a judge someday? You want to be a prosecutor? Look at these beautiful small, you know, we are a state of rural communities. Mm-hmm. And I love traveling the rural communities and meeting with the judges. Those judges, you want to know their community, those judges know their communities.
Right. Mm-hmm. They do. Now, artificial intelligence, can that help fill the void in legal representation?
You know, we have to stay ahead of AI. There's definitely things AI can do, but it can't do everything mm-hmm. on that. But I think there's two parts of technology. One, remote representation, using technology so maybe somebody can have an attorney that's in more densely populated area in a rural community, things like interpreters using that. We are looking at AI with regard to transcription. We have a mental health project where we have probably 19,000 involuntary mental health hearings in Indiana a year, and that's increased. And our judges are saying there's hardly a docket that doesn't have a mental health issue that comes before us. So how do we get those cases moving? Because if you're involuntarily committed, it's for 90 days, but then you really don't have a right to appeal because it can't come. So we're transcribing, using AI to do transcriptions. I think we need to responsibly use AI. It's not the panacea for figuring out how we're going to get out of the attorney crisis, but how do we leverage the good parts of AI? As judges, we have to train our judges. Maybe you have a piece of evidence that somebody's saying X, Y, and Z, but it's doctored. It's an AI mm-hmm. description. So is this research done by AI? Is this correct, or is this sort of garbage in, garbage out? So we have to, it's one of the many things that we are constitutionally charged with the administration of justice in the state that we've got to research, keep ahead of. And I have an innovation committee, and there's a judge from Evansville, I can't remember which judge it is right now, that is on that are working on these issues to bring recommendations to the court.
Is this part of your court technology push?
Yes.
Okay. Another important topic. One you're passionate about is the safety of court officials. The threats of violence, they're real. So have you ever been threatened?
Yes, many times, mm-hmm. monthly or more.
Have you ever been harmed?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, yes, I was a victim of a violent crime, a home invasion. My husband and I were both injured. It was a litigant who had come back later. Yeah, it was...
Was this in Tippecanoe County?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It was right at the when I started, right after I was elected judge.
Wow. Okay. So how can we better protect our court officials?
Well, I think be aware of the fact of sort of the cloud or the threat that these judges are under to make these tough decisions. As you're looking at public trust and confidence, these judges are signing on to a lot. And I think there's a fiscal ask on that with regard to the legislature. And with states, you know, I think one of my budget requests this year is to have the state help with funding for county judges, because the way we're not a unified court system, so everything doesn't come from Indianapolis. Vandiver County pays for everything for the judges, but for the judge's salary, they pay all the staff, the probation officers, security building. So I'm asking, and, you know, counties are tapped out. I mean, there's really fiscal, you know, things. So I'm asking that the state help fund that, because I really want judges to make decisions. You know, it's the old say, without fear or favor, I want judges to be able to make decisions without fear. And having been harmed myself and having just a number of threats, I thought it was a lot when I was a trial court judge, but it's a whole lot more now as Chief Justice.
And you travel with security now.
I do. I did not for the first maybe 10 years on the court, maybe 9 years, but now I have security most of the time, just for work.
Right. Okay. Now, you say that 98% of all cases are resolved in state courts, so they are loaded. You call them emergency rooms for society's ills, homelessness, domestic violence, substance abuse, mental illness, and the list goes on.
Right.
So these judges have a lot on their plate.
They have a lot on their plate. And again, I mean, you think about what people coming to court. I talked about involuntary mental health. We have over 1 million protective orders now in our protective order registry. We have evictions. We have the drug courts, the drug crimes, the violence crimes. I mean, there's really not a day on the Indiana Supreme. I had this as a trial court judge. There's a sort of a molester murder case that I'm looking at every single day in the Indiana Supreme Court. So it is. I mean, it's something to consider. So, like, be nice to your judges, people here in Vandenberg County. You've got some great ones, and they put a lot on the line, and they know that they're putting a lot on the line. But there is that higher purpose that, you know, what does justice look like in Indiana? And having that educated, safe judge who cares, you know, has a ton of compassion for their communities on those benches is just so important.
Now, still to come, we have more of my conversation with Indiana Chief Justice Loretta Rush. So why did she want to be a judge? We'll find that out. And what was that first day on the bench like? And much more. Court is in session on 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. My guest is Chief Justice of the Indiana Supreme Court, Loretta Rush, the first female Chief Justice in the state. 10 years and counting as the Chief Justice. Let's learn more about my guest. Where did you grow up?
I moved every year, 16 times from Hoboken to the south side of Chicago. My dad worked for the railroad, and then the railroad, it was Erie Lackawanna, ended, and then he worked for Wayne Works in Richmond, Indiana. He was sold school buses.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you end up in Indiana then? With the school bus job?
Yes. I lived up in Lake County when I worked for the railroad. I lived in Munster for a period of time. But it was really following, like, every sort of blue-collar train town from Hoboken to the south side of Chicago. We lived in, like, Marion, Ohio, Youngstown, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio. We lived in Elmira, New York. And then when that job ended, he got a job, and which I'm very happy because I love Indiana. Went great schools. Went to Purdue. Love Purdue, and went to law school at IU. Love IU.
I love the story about Richmond, Indiana, the school bus job that you had. This is a dream job for we were a teenager then?
Teenager,
What did you do?
We always worked. I mean, I started working when I was 14 at Earlham College in the cafeteria, but my dad sold school buses so I could make money, and I sort of put myself through college and law school. I was work study as well by driving school buses on weekends. I could drive a bus from Wayne Works in Richmond to New York or Maine, fly back, and really I remember it was like hundreds of dollars at that time.
And so these are brand new school buses.
These are new school buses.
That school corporations bought.
Yep.
And you transport them
I would.
And then fly back.
And then fly back. I would eat Twizzlers, which I love, and listen to Broadway show tunes, and that kept me going.
It's a dream job, definitely. I understand that you like to hike.
Yes. I like to hike and bike. I find great peace outdoors in mm-hmm. nature. So if on weekends, I bike every weekend. I try to hike.
What's been your favorite hiking trail?
Do you know, I just went back. I had a judicial conference of chief justices in Oregon, and it was called Silver Trails, and it was Oregon. It was 8 miles, and it was 10 waterfalls, and it was just beautiful.
Oh, my gosh.
I had a good fall on one, so I got some scars on my knee right now. But I like anything where I'm just out. It's sort of, you work very hard. You're in buildings working on these issues. Just, I find a real spirituality from being outside in nature.
Well, I looked at the Indiana's top hiking trails. Turkey Run,
yeah,
had a couple.
Done all of those.
And the dunes.
All of them.
And Clifty Falls. Have you done that one too? I've done
Clifty Falls. We live near Prophetstown. My kids every year give me a season pass to the, that's my Christmas gift, to the state parks.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's great. Okay. We were talking earlier. There's no one else in your family who took the career path of being a lawyer?
No, not. There weren't a lot. College was a big deal for me and my family. So, no, there were no lawyers, and there's nobody that went on. The some that went to college did not go on after college.
So why did you want to go into law?
I took a constitutional law class, and that sort of hooked. I went to Purdue. I thought I was going to be an engineer, and we were not. It was just not a marriage made in heaven, but I did marry an engineer.
Okay.
I married a mechanical engineer. I've been married a long time. But I always loved logic. I love history.
Mm-hmm.
I liked philosophy. I liked taking messy situations and applying order to them. And so I went to last minute decision. I mean, I never really thought it was a possibility for me. It was great meeting with the kids at the high school this morning, because seeing that in them, can I do it? They can. But it was a jump for me at that point.
So what was your major at Purdue then?
I ended up graduating. I took a semester off and went to backpack through Europe with a girlfriend. So I had to do a lot. I take like 21 hours a semester. But I graduated with a degree in economics, sociology, history, and government. So I was either going to teach at one level, mm-hmm. And then a minor in business. But I was just sort of piecing together different things I liked, and then waiting to figure out what my next step was. I didn't go in there just driven to do this. I always liked learning. I always liked history. I always liked seeing where our place was in history, because I think you need to know the past to know where you're going in the future. I thought I might teach. I might teach at some level, whether it's college mm-hmm. level or high school level.
Backpacking through Europe. Okay, you got to tell me about that. What are some of your favorite spots?
Well, I mean, it was the dollar was strong then. And
the good old days.
Yeah, so I mean, we traveled from England to Portugal to Spain to Italy to Greece to Austria, Germany, Norway,
how
Denmark.
Long was this?
I had 2 months. Two months.
Okay, that was great.
It was. It was really, at that point, it was eye-opening. I love, Fatima and Lourdes. And we timed it around being in Rome, the Vatican, on Easter. But I think it changes your, as a young woman, it changes your perspective on the world. The world doesn't seem as big when you travel and see the commonality of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Now, mentioning the Vatican, I know your husband's a church deacon.
Yes.
And you said your Catholic faith has shaped your career with valuable teachings regarding wisdom, humility, and justice. Without humility, we cannot have justice.
Well, you read one of my talks.
That's right. Is that a tattoo or something?
No. But okay. I think, you really want, you can't have justice without humility. If mm-hmm. you go in there thinking that you're better than the people that stand before you, it's problematic.
Mm-hmm. So that's that kind of guides you when you go into
it. It does.
Into your courts. And you were a law partner, and then you served on the Tippecanoe Superior Court for 14 years. Do you remember that those first cases as a sitting judge?
I did. It was juvenile court, which is a different kind of court, because really you're dealing with abuse, neglect, trauma, or troubled youth. And I thought, I thought I was in shape. I'd litigated. But your first 8 hours on the juvenile bench, seeing that amount of suffering, it was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started looking, okay, what can I change? I didn't want to make everybody wait out in the hallway forever. You've got to keep your court moving, keep your docket. I changed things around and had night court on Tuesday nights because I didn't want people to lose their job because they've got to go to court when they're already kind of holding on by a shoestring. Education for me with the children was very important. So I used to have truancy court at 7:30 on Thursday mornings. Why do you think I had it at 7:30 on Thursday mornings? Because don't miss school because you're not going to school. Okay. So you'd have the parents would have to come. I used to get out and visit with all the schools and meet with every ninth grader in the community every year as a juvenile judge to give them the same message. What choices? How can you stay out of juvenile court? But I love the juvenile bench.
Well, that's enough memories there for a book.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, did you take those cases home with you?
Sometimes you do. Sometimes you do. I mean, I had the kids used to give me pictures. So on my bench in Tippecanoe County, I was covered with the pictures of kids. And so my last day on the bench, I don't know if you want a story on this?
Sure, okay. Yes.
So last day on the bench, one of my kids wanted to serve as my bailiff, my youngest one, who was nine at the time. And I had a girl who'd been in my court many times. I was explaining to her that I was going down to Indianapolis. I got appointed as a justice, and she was not happy because sometimes the judge is the one constant in your life. Your foster parent, your caseworker, probation officer may change. And so she started crying, so I started crying. And so my son, like, did an army crawl under the bench. This big tissue came up, and he gave mom a tissue so I could blot my eyes. So, yes, you can't – these judges, what you say, I call it vicarious trauma. You know, I had shaken baby cases where you've got to make the decision on the ventilator for a child
or
molest cases. So you're not impervious to them. But I think what keeps you strong is just saying, what can you do to make it better? You know, these kids have been harmed. Don't let the system harm them. So what can we do from our point to help them get their lives turned around and get back?
I know my first day of retirement after 41 years at WFIE-TV, I was seated on a jury, and it was a child molestation case. And usually I've been called to jury, but they didn't ever pick me because I was in the media. But they said, you're retired now. I said, yes. So they seated me on the jury.
Okay.
So I sat through this trial, and it's very emotional. I mean, both sides are very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
It was a young, teenage girl. And
did she have to testify in the courtroom?
Yes, she did. And this older man who was the defendant. Back and forth and back and forth. And then we go into the jury to deliberate. I mean, you got two sides there, and it's really tough.
It is tough.
It really is tough. You have a sympathy for this young lady, but then there was no evidence. And that's eventually we had to acquit the guy because there was really no evidence there. But, I mean, it works on you.
It really does. I mean, but that's the key. I mean, is there evidence? People, you know, you look at when you talk about the attorney shortage, you really want to go into court on something that maybe you didn't do. And you didn't, even if you did, to make sure that it was done. So, yes, those are tough cases.
Now, you served on the, you were chair of the Indiana Juvenile Justice Improvement Committee. You were named Juvenile Judge of the Year. Served on national committees to protect the rights of children. So, what are some top issues on that agenda?
Well, that's part of you said, how do you do it, not take the case at home? I think by doing things better, by looking at time frames. Kids shouldn't be sitting in foster care for years before they get permanency. What laws need to be tweaked and changed? And then let's hold the agencies that are supposed to be caring and safeguarding the kids, let's hold them accountable if they're not doing what they need to be doing. If a child's sitting there and been harmed, but they haven't had a caseworker see them for a period of time. So there is a lot of laws that I've testified in a lot of legislation with regard to kids. And then when I came down to the Supreme Court, I worked with the legislature, started a children's commission, where we got all the policymakers for kids together on a committee. And then we brought content experts in to educate us on how we can work together. Things like improving the lives of kids, information sharing. You maybe have a foster parent or, you know, how do you get information to make sure that this child's in school or doing this and that? So there's a lot of steps that we took.
You have been quoted as saying you look forward to a time when a woman on the bench is unremarkable. Now, when you were sworn in as the first female Chief Justice in Indiana, did you feel that extra scrutiny?
I think so. I mean, I remember I got asked the question, and I'd had four kids, and our oldest was actually, we adopted, he had been in foster care, and so I had another child, and then another 12 years later, I had another one. So when I was interviewing for the Supreme Court, I remember getting the question, or maybe this was for Chief Justice, about work-life balance. I thought, did you ask the guys the work-life balance question? I've been working on this. I think I'll be okay. So I think there was a little bit of just focused on the female. I mean, I really respect Governor Daniels. He made a point to say, I'm not, you know, this isn't just a diversity hire, that
right.
we want somebody that's able to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thrilled that I have so many more, probably a third of the judges are women in Indiana now. Mm-hmm. And that's, I just need another one on my court.
I know I've interviewed three of the appellate judges, the ladies, and they were guests. All remarkable women, definitely. My guest is Chief Justice of the Indiana Supreme Court, Loretta Rush. Your job title is supervising the entire judicial branch. That sounds like a big job. And we talked about your take on having cameras in the courtroom. Good idea?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody agrees with me, but I look at it from this standpoint. Our currency is public trust. And if you have a dispute, you need to trust that you're going to get it fairly adjudicated. And if you don't know what's going on in the judiciary, it's problematic. So cameras go in to show the hard, dedicated work our judges are doing, how they bring fairness, how you have these tough situations and you try to get order from them. So I like cameras in the courtroom, but we've left it up to the judges. I mean, if a judge does not want cameras in the courtroom or thinks it's going to be—
It's their call.
It's their call. Or mm-hmm. if it's going to be problematic, you don't want a child witness, the case you talked about. I mean, you don't want a child witness to talk
no.
about being victimized on that. But there's a lot that are—it's interesting. And I think people—and the judges that have done it, I've met with a lot of them. They thought I was worried about it. But, you know, those cases, people are not— playing to the camera. They think that, oh, you're playing to the camera. I had a camera in my courtroom as a juvenile judge because we were doing these we were doing the record that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just turned just so they couldn't see themselves, and nobody even paid attention that mm-hmm. the camera was out.
Well, if it becomes normal and routine.
Yes.
No big deal. Now, the Indiana Supreme Court decisions, and there are written opinions, 9 justices on the court. So how many agree on a decision, and who writes the opinions?
We have, our Constitution allows us to have 9. We actually have 5.
Okay.
So we have 5 justices, but 15 court of appeals, the next layer down. We do a lot of research. We have an oral argument on about every case, and then we sit and figure out where the majority is, and then I assign the cases.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of input from them with regard to, I'd like to write on this, or maybe it's a new justice who hasn't covered this area before. Maybe it'd be good if you wrote this. And we try to sort of even it out.
Do you get like in a small room? And
we're in a small room all the time. Like yesterday we had, it's not small, it's a conference room. But we sit around a table after we have oral arguments, and we're together a lot to find out where the center of gravity is in case. We're like 65, 70% unanimous on cases.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got tough issues that come before us where mm-hmm. we have to have, because it's not just the case that comes before us, it's what's the impact of the case that comes before us on future cases. So
the precedent.
The precedent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot goes into assigning it, and then that's just the beginning, and then you write it, it gets circulated, there may be a dissent, there may be some fine-tuning of it. We have a very, even though we don't agree on every issue, we have a very collaborative court. We're together a lot, we get along well, and it's really a credit to Indiana. I give Chief Justice Shepard, he's sort of institutionalized collegiality on the Indiana Supreme Court.
And he's in the other room there.
He's making sure I don't mess up.
That's right. He's monitoring you. Now, coming up, we have more important issues to talk about on our court docket. Direct access to justice, return on investment, and the importance of providing fair and impartial justice. Your statement on race and equity. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you're just joining us, my guest is Indiana Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush. Now, we talked about the importance of public trust and confidence in the court system, and that means fair and impartial treatment for everyone. Now, in 2020, you had issued a statement on race and equity, 5 points that judicial officers should focus on to confront racial discrimination. 1, increased implicit bias training. What's that?
Well, just training our judges, and it's a very specific training, and they've done that to make sure that they're not, you know, think about this. So when you're a juvenile court judge and you're dealing with people that live in poverty, you know, and I did a sort of poverty simulation, it may be impossible for them to say, okay, you've got to go meet with this therapist, get a job, go here, go here, go there. You've got to sort of see people where they're at. So implicit bias means that you don't maybe impose your socioeconomic values on the people that come before your court. You see them wherever they're at.
And accountability.
accountability is, well, that's a lot of what we do in the criminal justice system is accountable. So how do you sentence someone, hold them accountable for their crime, but also work with them so that they understand, you know, let's see somebody suffering with substance abuse, but you're also dealing. You know, you can't deal with just their substance abuse and get them treatment. They've got to be accountable for the fact that they're dealing. So Okay. Accountability is always part of the criminal justice system.
Number three, compassion for the vulnerable and disadvantaged.
Yeah. I mean, I think looking at that, when I talk about the people that come in who have been multi-generational, sort of poverty, substance abuse, instead of just having a punitive approach, sometimes try to figure out a way to give them the court system, give them the helping hand out of that so that you're not piling on. And here's an example. We have really traumatized children that have been through just horrors that you would not imagine. And you don't want to come and put them in a court system and put them in the room with their abuser. Or you want, you know, what can we do to make their court experience better to protect them? Mm-hmm. And it's problematic. And the disadvantage is, let's say that you are that grandmother that wants to get custody of your, but you have no money. So we have done like IndianLegalHelp.org. We've got the Coalition of Court Access. How do we make volunteer lawyers available to those who can't? For maybe you're a veteran that you want to be able to access services or get VA benefits. How do we make sure those services are available to you regardless of your social economic class? Mm-hmm. So I think civil legal aid really goes to that.
Also, improving the pathway for more people of color to become judges and lawyers.
Yeah, I think that I've always been an advocate for diversity on the bench. I think it's important that we make sure that there's no roadblocks for people so that we have more diversity on the bench, because it's really been studied. I mean, there's more trust you have in the judiciary when the judges look like the people that are coming before them on a regular basis.
And number five, equitable treatment of children across the court system.
Yeah, there was a statistic that came out that, you know, children of color in Indiana, at the time that I wrote the statement, and I have not received updated information, were in the foster care system four times longer than children who were not of color. So, okay, we have this statistic. What can we do about it? Mm-hmm. You know, where are the barriers that we have to that? Because it's not good for any child to be in the foster care system very long. And if we know that is so, what do we need to do to look at that population and find out the whys so it's not like 10 years from now it's, you know, six times as long?
Well, this all sounds good on paper. So what's been the impact of that statement?
I mean, I think we've really looked at that. We've had trainings for judges. I mean, right now in Indiana, women and judges of color are now a third or more of the bench, where it used to be less than that. We do a lot of public speaking. We have a program called the iCLEO program that Justice Shepherd started, and it's for anyone that is maybe first generation, any type of disadvantage that you're not on the path to go to law school. How do we get you on that path to go to law school? So we're seeing that happen. Mm-hmm. With our judges, we've got a Myra Selby has been really good. She's done forums around the state with regard to public trust and confidence. What are the barriers? Why do people feel like there's a two-tier system of justice? And then we sort of work on getting that done. Justice David led sort of a multi-branch group to look at these, came up with recommendations, and we're working through those recommendations. The whole report is on our website, and where we are on the recommendations are as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the phrase you use, direct access to justice, what does that mean?
That's a big phrase.
It is.
You're not like four ticks away from it, right? That you're somebody that needs to access the legal system to, you know, it's like veteran. Here's an example. We have a lot of veterans in Indiana, and we have a number of veterans that come back from different tours of duty and get themselves in the criminal justice system. How do we find them and get them into veterans court? So we develop technology that if somebody gets arrested who's a veteran, we get them help right away to get them to see if they qualify for veterans court.
I don't understand veterans court. What's that?
Oh, it's a court that for veterans. So if you have it's usually substance abuse or mental health or a combination. So we have courts where there are criminal charges against the veterans, and we work with the VA, and we pair them up with a veteran, and we have a judge who's trained on veterans courts, and they come to court, and if they're able to kind of follow the law, get work, work on their substance abuse or mental health or both, then their charges in some cases can be expunged. But it's a specialized court that we've really done a lot in Indiana. We have tripled our problem-solving courts, and veterans is one of them, because we feel like we, you know, let's give a hand back to those that have done so much for us and mm-hmm. have come back with some special needs.
Issuing limited licenses to practice law, licensing paralegals, online law schools, that's all part of your, I guess, your push to increase the legal representation?
Those are not in place right now. That's what's being studied. Okay. And then they'll bring the recommendations to the court to what does the future of the court system look like. And so these are recommended. We study what's going, what are other states doing, what's working, how do we make sure that people have that direct access to justice by having an attorney if they need that. So we have people in this area, people from all over the state that are giving us information. We have legislators on it, and they will be coming to us, and we will have to make those decisions.
I think one of the other points was loan forgiveness to practice law in rural areas as well. Now, the phrase return on investment, you've used that before.
Yes. I mean, I try to – it's hard sometimes as a separate branch of government when you go to another branch to get funding for your branch. And so I look at courts as engines of economic development. You know, the sooner you can get to court, get your contract dispute, to get your child support done, get your housing issue, the better you can get back to work, and it's better for your community. So I think when you look at the sheer volume of cases we have, the types of cases we have, that having a well-run court system is good for the economy. The Chamber of Commerce had a report that said like 80% of companies look at the litigation environment of state before they do business or expand. Mm. So that's on us, right? Mm-hmm. So we have developed commercial courts. You've got a business court down here in Evansville, and we think that's important.
Time is money. Sure is. So what are your goals for the coming years and the challenges facing the judicial system?
Well, I'm up for retention. I got to get retained.
Right.
And I think I worry about the lack of trust or so too much focus on this case or that case as opposed to looking what we're doing globally. You may not like that we resolved this case, but read the case. There was an article in a local paper that talked about like an energy case that only had one side, but we have found for and against energy companies based on what the law is written. So know that we care about the people that come before us. Do not vote. Don't say I'm going to vote all judges out, because I think there will be chaos. I mean, look at the judge, read the opinions on that. So first I've got to get through retention. I don't think that's a given, particularly in this environment right now. But the goals would be to make sure the court's in as good a shape when I leave it as Chief Justice Shepherd left it, that justice, that access to justice is met in Indiana, and that the high standards that we set for our judges and our legal professions continue to be met.
So you have to have a passion for this job, right?
Yes.
I think you do. Indiana Chief Justice Loretta Rush, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street, and I guess underscoring the importance of having public trust and confidence in the men and women who make sure justice is served fairly and impartially. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you.
In her State of the Judiciary speech, Chief Justice Loretta Rush thanked the legislature for funding a number of projects to put offenders back on track, and she called such funding an investment in Indiana's future. Here's what she had to say before the General Assembly.
In last year's address, I described how Indiana courts are engines of economic development, fairness, and public safety. This year, we are eager to show you the return on your investment, the proverbial bang for the buck your funding has produced. We are incredibly grateful for your trusted financial commitment to the judiciary. Thank you. Your investment has paid huge dividends, enhancing operational efficiencies in the courts and improving the lives of Hoosiers we all serve. Your funding has allowed us to expand problem solving in commercial courts, address rural needs, leverage technology through innovation, and build public trust through outreach. And you know what? We're just getting started. Courts are a primary referral source to get people to treatment, but there are huge barriers when a county has no service providers, no problem-solving courts, or not enough attorneys. And no one sees a return on investment when we have justice by geography, where a person in one county can get help but gets locked up in another because the same resources aren't present. To address those concerns, over 200 rural justice stakeholders met last October with public health professionals for a first-of-its-kind summit. The purpose was to develop solutions for accessing treatment and promoting rehabilitation in under-resourced areas. And one of those resources is lawyers, and we're facing a shortage. Several counties are struggling to fulfill the constitutional required positions of judge, prosecutor, and public defender. And legal providers can't fill the gaps for all civil matters, such as child support, guardianships, wills, and adoptions. We're calling on some who attended the summit to help us find solutions. Such innovation means examining broader pathways to legal education and bar admission, alternative forms of law licensure, and ways to encourage rural and public sector practices. Finding solutions will take all of us working together. One highlight of that summit was the realization that thanks to the landmark legislation you passed last year, we are cutting red tape and accessing funding and providing technical assistance to transform behavioral health. I have to thank all of you. Your largest recent investment in the judiciary was directed at improving court technology, and for that part of the tour, we're everywhere. We are aligning the legal systems in all 92 counties with the demands of a digital age. When our framers crafted the court shall be open provision of the Indiana Constitution over 200 years ago, they never could have imagined the remarkable ways we could leverage technology today. And you, as a modern day framers of our laws, your investment in court technology has allowed us to be pioneers in our own right. Indiana is recognized as a national leader in court technology, allowing 24/7 access to the courts. Visit our website, you'll see searchable databases, a child support calculator, court calendars, ticket payment and marriage license processing, court hearings, both live and archived, just to name a few. Last year, 11 million people accessed the MyCase system, and they viewed over 63 million pages. We provide free electronic filing for the 8 million legal documents filed last year. We also send out text message reminders of court hearings by the millions. These efforts not only produce incredible cost savings, but they empower Hoosiers to be on top of their case and get it resolved. And isn't that what good government is all about? It's no surprise that court customers would want to get a text message reminder about a hearing or pay a traffic ticket online, but do Hoosiers want to attend court online? We weren't sure. So we welcomed Indiana University researchers to take an impartial look. Like many, they were skeptical that people would be satisfied with having their day in court remotely. And we were particularly interested in the experiences of vulnerable Hoosiers. Well, that research revealed loudly and resoundly online civil courts enhance access to justice for unrepresented litigants. For a person who has to find a ride to court, miss work, or get childcare, remote access is not only about flexibility, it's the linchpin to getting their case resolved, getting justice. Simply logging onto a remote hearing at times is far more practical than jumping the hurdles that can accompany attending court in person. Just as people want their cases resolved quickly, so do businesses. Our tour of Indiana wouldn't be complete without stops in Allen, Elkhart, Floyd, Hamilton, Lake, Madison, Marion, St. Joseph, Vigo, and Vandenberg counties, highlighting the 10 commercial court counties that are open for businesses across the state. We crafted our commercial courts to deliver predictability and efficiency. We now have a free searchable database of commercial court decisions so businesses can research how similar disputes are resolved. And we have free Indiana commercial court treaties that lawyers can look to when advising their clients and preparing for court. Nearly 2,000 cases have been filed in these courts, and our data shows that the parties are getting their decisions in these complicated business disputes more quickly. We're even hearing from lawyers throughout the state that now routinely include provisions and contracts that require disputes be litigated exclusively in the commercial courts of Indiana. Let's think about that for a moment. When Hoosier businesses are negotiating valuable deal points and contracts, things like price, quantity, quality, delivery times, they now see value in agreeing that any disputes must be resolved in Indiana's commercial courts. It's outstanding. I began my remarks with an invitation to come see an appellate case in person. That's because trust and confidence in the courts are bolstered when people are able to see firsthand the precision in which the laws you've crafted are considered. Our Court of Appeals knows this. They do incredible work to make sure cases are open and accessible to the public. But this isn't just my humble opinion. They have, in fact, been declared the best in the country. They were honored last summer with the prestigious National Sandra Day O'Connor Award for Civics Education. Through their one-of-a-kind Appeals on Wheels program, the 15 judges regularly traverse the state, bringing appellate proceedings to over 600 communities in all 92 counties. To you, the legislature, thank you for the increased funding you provided us. Your increased investment in courts is an investment that bolsters the bedrock of democracy. It allows us to better serve Hoosiers with behavioral health needs, strengthen individual communities, help families, leveraging technology, and increasing public trust through outreach and access. I want to specifically highlight one thing that you have done, or better stated, 100 things that you have done to ensure Indiana's judiciary remains the envy of so many other states. You have now appointed 100 judges to the bench. You hold a remarkable place in history, not only due to the number of your appointments, but also due to the quality of your appointments. One of your legacies, among many, is that of a strong judiciary. So be confident that your judiciary will continue to be strong. We will continue to respect the wise investment that you've done by giving us the funding you've had the past year. And may God continue to bless our great state. Thank you very much.
Indiana Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush speaking to the General Assembly earlier this year. In voting this week, she and two other justices were retained for another 10 years on the bench. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.